Merkel Media.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Look, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary is Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on Iconic, Rockfin, Odyssey, or YouTube, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thank you so much. We appreciate your support. You can check out the website at theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. You can find me on Twitter at Macroaggressions, though I don't pretend that I'm going to stay there for much longer. And big thank you to our sponsors, as usual. We have, if you are interested in converting some of your Federal Reserve fiat dollars, whatever you want to call them, into something tangible like gold or silver, Tony Arterburn at Wise Wolf can help you make that happen. They set up a landing page for us. You can just go to www.macroaggressions.gold. And from there, there's a contact form. You can reach out to Tony, tell him what you're looking for. He can even help you convert your IRAs and 401ks into physical metal. So something to consider if you are worried about hyperinflation, or you're just worried about regular inflation, or if you just don't trust the US dollar, something to consider. And if you are also looking for, I don't know, gifts for friends and family, silver is nice. You can always send them silver. So take a look, www.macroaggressions.gold. Also, our newest sponsor, or one of our newest sponsors, True Hemp Science. They're making some great hemp-based CBD out of a shop in Austin, Texas. They sent me several bottles. I've been taking it for a couple weeks now. It's been fantastic. It has made the pain in my left shoulder go away. I'm very excited about that. Thank you to the guys over there. What they sent me and what I've been taking is number 19 and number 41. So if you are interested, you can go to truehempscience.com/macroaggressions and see what they've got. They've got all kinds of things. If you, they'll tell you about the freebies, if you go to the landing page, what they'll give you, but free shipping on anything $150 or more. We love supporting small businesses. So if you are interested, use the promo code macro on your way out, truehempscience.com, and get your CBD on. It seems like everybody's got CBD these days, but these guys are making a really good batch of it. So, well, I'm really excited to get into this. It's not every day that you get an author that can talk about the sorts of things that I'm really into, like reimagining government, reimagining our relationship with government. So he is the author of many books, but the newest book is An End to Upside Down Liberty. We got Mark Gober here. What's going on, Mark? Good to see you.
Charlie, thanks so much for having me. This is going to be fun.
Well, look, your book. So your new book is right up my alley, right? An End to Upside Down Liberty. I mean, I think describing what we have as upside down liberty is very generous and nice of you. I think I might have described it as, you know, with the harsher terms, but explain me, you've got several books in this series putting an end to upside down this and that. So talk to me about the first couple books that you wrote and where this sort of adventure took you.
Sure. Well, let me tell you my journey, because I didn't expect to be here. Let's put it that way. The last thing I would have predicted, talking about these topics. So my background is very much from the mainstream. I went to Princeton undergrad. I was a competitive athlete growing up. I was one of the captains of the tennis team there. So really focused on like academic sports, wasn't thinking about government, wasn't thinking about some of these bigger questions at all. Went into investment banking right out of undergrad. So this was 2008, right during the crisis. So I started in the summer of 2008 before it got really, really bad. And then I was there through the worst of it.
Great.
It was brutal.
Bad timing.
Yeah. But I learned. I mean, I saw a lot. It was not good for my mental or physical health, but I did it until 2010, and then left to join a firm first in Boston and then in the Bay Area, where I spent 10 years basically doing a combination of investment banking work and strategy consulting work, advising tech companies on intellectual property strategy.
Gotcha.
So that's my background. This journey started for me in 2016. I was listening to podcasts, mostly focused on business and health. I wasn't looking for something new, but I heard about some concepts related to consciousness, which is generally our sense of experiencing life. It's difficult to describe because we can't touch our consciousness, but we all have it. And basically, my paradigm shifted on the way I look at the nature of reality, like the fundamental aspect of reality. It flipped for me when I started looking at science. And then a year later in 2017, I said, why don't I put this on paper? So I wrote a book called NENTAT Upside Down Thinking, looking at the relationship between our brain and consciousness, nature of reality, why do we exist, stuff like that. Yeah. And published in 2018. Then in 2019, I released a podcast series where I interviewed dozens of scientists, including a Nobel Prize winner in physics, researchers from UVA, Princeton, the top people on consciousness. It's called Where Is My Mind? So that was keeping me busy while I was still working. But then at the end of 2019, decided that I wanted to leave my firm, even though I didn't know what I was going to do next. I had made it to partner, but it just like wasn't aligned. And I was so interested in this other stuff. So this was pre-pandemic. At the time, I didn't know this was going to happen. Yeah, right. And early 2020, went on a few meditation retreats for the first time ever, which was pretty profound for me because I was always so busy and couldn't sit still for 5 minutes. But in between two meditation retreats, there was one that was about a week long, one was maybe 6 days. I wrote the second book and ended up Upside Down Living, which is about living, what's the approach to life based on what I wrote in my first book. Yeah. And that was done in the beginning of 2020 when the pandemic hit. And I was able to then just watch what was happening in terms of current events. And this is where we get into the new book. Yeah. And I saw a pattern of activity where there was a mainstream narrative, and then a doctor would come out and say something that countered the narrative that sounded pretty benign. And then they're booted off YouTube. You know, the censorship was out of control, number one, but also our sense of freedom and our relationship to government for the first time in my life became very obvious. I never thought about politics. I wasn't a political person, but it's like your business is essential. Yours isn't. You have to stay in your home. You have to do this in this state, but not in this state. What's going on here?
Right.
So as you know, you've been on this for a lot longer than I have. Yeah. But anyway, that's what initiated this whole thing. But for me, I think one of the reasons I was receptive to it, because given like my network of people, most of them are like very bought into the narrative. Mm-hmm. I saw this with regard to consciousness research, where there'd be credible scientists saying, look, there's all this statistical evidence here. And then other people saying, no, it doesn't exist. And then like the media pushing it in one direction. And I also saw professionally lots of corruption in certain cases, especially in the field of intellectual property, where you have like new inventors challenging an industry. I saw some stuff that opened my eyes in my mid-20s. I'm 35 now. So I was probably primed for this. And I saw this pattern. And the more I looked at it, the more I got into the stuff that you've been on for a while. And I was thinking about, like, okay, here are the problems, which I don't fully understand myself, but I'm very interested in. But what's a solution? And that's where it gets into the nature of government. And that's ultimately what this book is about, is viewing government as predator rather than protector, in summary.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think though to maybe some of the outsiders or people that aren't too familiar, they might go, well, that's a very aggressive way to look at things. I think that actually we should. It is the difference between when you say, well, that person has to earn my trust, or that person, or another philosophy is, well, they start off with 100% trust and they can only go down from there, as opposed. So with regard to the government, look, we have thousands of years of examples of across a variety of societies of how governments get put together. And what tends to happen, regardless of what age you are in, what geographic location you're in, what tends to sort of happen in almost all the cases is that it works as a magnet for psychopaths that want to be that have this need to control others and to be in charge, and they don't get hung up on things like trampling other people to get there, or making decisions that harm large groups of people. They have no moral hang up with that. So we find ourselves just sort of over time, our governments get infested by the wrong type of people. And so we wind up in these battles where it seems like it's us against the government. And that, of course, it is, but it's us against the psychopaths that find themselves in government. So I think that you're right in your assessment that, you know, like we have to start with, like, these people should not be trusted. You start in. So, like, the main question of your book, right, of the new book, really is, okay, well, all this stuff is screwed up and government is weird, so how should society be organized?
Exactly.
Yeah. So I don't know that there is necessarily a one size fits all answer for this, but I'm interested to know what you found.
Yeah. Well, I looked at this question from two perspectives. One is the traditional political and economic theory perspective, and then another, which is tying it to the metaphysics. So for me, there's an optimal angle from the metaphysical lens, but even ignoring that, if we think about government, when I say that it's predator, I view it now as predator rather than protector. I mean that the structure itself is inherently predatory, and there's a spectrum. So you have like Nazi Germany, North Korea, Soviet Union, where everyone acknowledges it was clearly predatory. But even governments that are supposedly parts of free countries, they have aspects that could lead us there because of the structure. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing that all over the world today, where all of a sudden governments are locking people down and making decisions that change our lives. So how should it be structured, to get to your question? What I argue is that, and like many others have as well, our current structure is known as statism. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's the term for it, that there is a state that rules the people effectively. And one of the features of that state, which I hadn't thought about until I started to research this, is that we don't have an explicit contractual agreement with it. We have an implied consent. And why is that so important? Because the government, if you think about what it does, it provides services. So legal service, like courts, police, roads, these are all very important things. So I don't deny that. But unlike other service providers like Netflix or your gym or my clients when I worked, there was an agreement as to what would happen. So, like, as to my clients, there would be terms, like things that we were obligated to do, things that would happen if we didn't fulfill those obligations, a pricing structure that was in place, and both parties mutually agreed on that.
Right.
We don't have that explicitly with our government, and our government's a service provider with really important services. So ultimately, what you end up with is a structure that can impose on people its will. And in short, what I'm arguing is that the government's functions should easily exist, but it should become a true service provider with contractual agreements with customers in a free market.
You know what government reminds me of sometimes? It reminds me of the auto mechanic, where you don't know what the bill is until you go to pick up your car at the end. And they're like, oh, what was this, this, this? And you're like, where's the menu with all the prices? I didn't agree to that. Or this seems like, it seems like you're making it up as you go along. So I like the idea that, you know, I mean, maybe some people would say, well, when you're born in America, you get a social security card and then they own you and they trade you on Wall Street and all these things. I don't know, like maybe maritime law, all that stuff. I don't know. But you're right in the sense that we're sort of like, you're born in this geographic spot, and that means that you're under the control of this government and all the rules and regulations that come along with that. Have fun. And you're like, I didn't ask to be born here. I didn't agree to this. I don't know these people. These people don't represent me. I don't, my align, my thought, the way I view things are not in alignment with my government. I would like to break this contract. I don't even have a contract. I would like to break this this implied contract. So now we get into like the legal components of government. Do they even have a right to rule over us? Or are we just sort of going along on a like day-to-day contract, a day-to-day implied contract with these people?
Yeah. I mean, the way I see it, there's an implied contract because we can't point to an explicit contract that lays out all the things the government's doing and the agreement between us. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure people would make a case and say, well, the implication is strong enough that the relationship is there. What I'm arguing is why not make it more explicit for functions that are so important and for an organization that has led to so much death and destruction and enslavement throughout history? Why not make it explicit? Well, there are a lot of people in power who wouldn't want that to be the case for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd like to see the terms of service contract for them. But then again, you get the feeling it would be like you'd get an email like you do from Google that says, we've updated our terms of service. And you're like, so what? But I don't get a say in it. You know, it's like, well, so right. I wonder if the government would be like, oh yes, we'll put out our terms of service agreement. And then they just constantly update it in the middle of the night on page 3000. When you're not looking and there's this one little word that's been turned from without to within and whatever. Next thing you know, you're under control. It's funny that, it's just an interesting way to look at our relationship that we have with government, because like you're right, like everything else, you know, in our Western world is sort of contractually spelled out, and even for things that are like insignificant really in our day-to-day life, like who cares, you have to sign the thing to go into the whatever, the waiver to go into the gym that you don't belong to, your friend is there and wants you to come with them, you have to sign the waiver, like whatever. But we don't have any of that paperwork for the most important component of our lives, which is the government that we live under. That is a strange relationship that we have with government. We've just collectively decided that that's cool.
Right. That's cool. And that's moral. And we have this social contract that people talk about, which doesn't actually exist.
Right.
That we allow these people to rule us because that's going to keep us safer somehow. That's, to me, seems like some kind of manipulative abstraction.
Yeah.
It's not real.
Yeah, it does. It does. So we're in this situation. We've got sort of like various forms of government, some top down, some of them more, you know, democratic or republic or whatever. But in the end, we don't really have as much of a say as we would like to. So if we are able to, let's say we're able to take a piece of land and start over with this and do it the way we collectively want to do that. What are we talking? We're talking about voluntary exchanges. We're talking about some different forms of private property rights. Like where would we even start in a project like that? Where would be the best components of this to focus on so that we could live in a society where we felt we were valued and treated fairly and we had the ability to prosper if we chose to, or we have the ability to do nothing if we chose to as well? Like, how do you see this?
Well, so the key principle is actually pretty simple, and this is based on philosophers like Murray Rothbard, leading political economists, people in that area, and it's non-aggression toward private property. So I'll break that down because I can say that in one sentence really easily, but that's the whole thing, really. Non-aggression means you don't initiate aggression against someone else's body or anything that they own. What's aggression? Physical violence, extortion, coercion, fraud, theft, things like that. But you have a right to self-defense if someone does that to you or your property.
Right.
How do we define private property? Well, it's something that you own. There's a term in economics known as homesteading, where let's say you have a piece of clay. This is what Murray Rothbard refers to. You have a piece of clay that's a natural resource. But if you're a sculptor, you mold it into a sculpture. And so you mix your person with the natural resource, and then it becomes your property. And then you can trade it. So this would go for land too. You know, if you clean off the leaves in a certain place, or you build a home and you have certain boundaries, you have these pieces of property that you own that you can trade in some manner. And that's it. So the rules for any given private property would exist. They could be the laws for, let's say there's a community of people that subscribe to the same rules, i.e. laws, within a certain area of land. And by subscribing to that, you have consented and there's some contractual relationship. And then you can interact with other parties as you see fit. And all the functions that we have from government, which again, our current government, which are very important, they would exist within a free competitive market. So there would be accountability. Like right now, if the government screws something up, they're still going to have taxpayer funding, or they could essentially print money out of thin air. Right. No accountability. If you don't do well in a free market, like if, let's say you're a grocery store and the apples you sell are rotten and the food you sell is rotten, people are going to stop coming in there. You go out of business. And in a free competitive market, you then incentivize entrepreneurs to come up with creative solutions to the things that people need.
Yeah. Yeah. I've written in the Controlled Demolition book that I wrote with Jeff Berwick, we were talking about the invisible hand, the Adam Smith's invisible hand. And I just sort of described that, like what we have now with the rigged marketplaces and the fraud and all of the buddy system in Washington and what Adam Smith's invisible hand is giving the invisible middle finger to the marketplaces, because what it's done is it's corrupted all of these. You have LIBOR and Forex and COMEX all busted. You know, all the big banks got busted for rigging these marketplaces. What we have right now is like a rigged version of that. So it would be nice to get ourselves to a place where, I don't know, you felt like you were conducting your business in a marketplace where the scales were actually balanced, in unlike where we are now. Because, you know, like you started off initially by saying, this industry has to close down, but this one can stay open. Or these types of businesses during COVID had to stay closed, all these mom and pop shops, but Walmart could stay open. And people look at that and they go, this doesn't seem fair. It doesn't seem right. It doesn't seem logical, reasonable. But on top of all that, it doesn't seem fair. I sometimes get the feeling that the Walmarts of the world maybe have undue influence and they're able to have different rules and regulations. So is it a matter of the rules applying to everybody? Is that, that's got to be a component of a new sort of system, right? Where nobody is necessarily above the rules, right?
Yeah. Well, to me, the rules would be on the basis of individual private property or collective property if people subscribe to certain things, and then you would be bound to those rules within those confines. Whereas right now, the rules are imposed by a government structure, whether we like it or not, whether we agree to it or not. And it's not fully capitalistic in that sense, because it's not fully free. And that's a distinction. We talk about how we're a capitalistic society, but really there is a merger between corporations and government. They can influence the policies. And in economic terms, when you have the merger of corporations and government, you call that fascism.
Yes, you do.
So there's a quote I love from PJ O'Rourke, who said, once buying and selling are controlled by legislation, the first things to be bought and sold are legislators.
Yes. Yes. And I would suggest that has been happening for a very long time. It's, and we can look at that through the lens just recently of people that are going, living through this COVID situation and the pharmaceutical industry. There's a lot of people, it's their first time understanding that the pharmaceutical industry has different rules in terms of what you can and can't do. Like, you can't sue them for certain things. And people go, "Why? That seems unusual. Why did that happen?" It's like, well, in 1986, the pharmaceutical industry decided that they were going to invest in people. And the people that they invested in were the Congress people. And they found that was the greatest investment they could ever make, was to get them to rewrite the laws so that they couldn't be sued for their faulty products. And so that is where we currently stand. I think a lot of people are getting a lesson on that. And like you rightly said, that's fascism. Like, that, when you start blending the corporation and the state, it's either corporatism on one side, or it's fascism, or however you want to define it. But it's unsustainable for the rest of society. And the people are clearly starting to rise up. But you have this, like you said, in your book, in the new book, there's an interesting component to all of this. Like you said, it's the metaphysical layer, the consciousness layer, which I think it's discounted, especially when you're talking about government. It's all this political science and the science of politics and everything, but the science part seems to be left out. And we are not just walking around in this meat suit. There's more to this universe than just us. There's more to what's going on than what we can see or what we can hear or what we can feel. There's a whole lot happening out there in the world. It would be arrogant and we would organize society in a way detrimental to our own existence if we were to discount the role of consciousness, right?
Yes. Exactly. And for me, when I think about the structure of government, where it can force things upon people, it can force you with its laws to do things that you personally find immoral, but it's the law. So that's the government's morality. There's all these problems when things are imposed on people. To me, from the metaphysical lens, which it took me a while to get to this point, statism on its face is a non-starter. You can't have that. You can't have a system that's not fully voluntary.
Right.
And the principle is known as the golden rule of not doing to others. You do to others as you would want to be done to yourself.
Right.
And, I arrive at this looking at like near-death experiences, for example, things that people experience when their brain shut off. And this is a study at the University of Virginia, et cetera, where that becomes very clear that is potentially built into the nature of reality itself. And if you buy that, which at this point I do, after this all this research I've done, it not only aligns with my common sense, but as Dr. Bruce Grayson from the University of Virginia, who studied millions of these cases of near-death experiences, there's a life review phenomenon where people report reliving their whole life in a flash, and they relive the events not only through their own eyes, but through the eyes of the people that they impacted. So, for example, I interviewed a guy named Daniel Brinkley, who's had 4 near-death experiences, and this is for my podcast, Where Is My Mind? Each time he had a life review, which not everyone does, Dr. Grayson says it's about 25% of the cases, he had to relive the deaths of the people that he killed in Vietnam, and he told me he was vicious in combat. He was living it through the eyes of the person that he killed, and he felt the pain of the child that would no longer have a father because he had killed the father. So when he came back, like many other people who have these experiences, unlike hallucinations where people don't have such dramatic life shifts, he became a hospice volunteer. So what he said in his later life reviews, he claims, he felt what it was like to be the dying person in the hospice bed, looking into his eyes as he comforted that person. So he got to feel the good stuff.
Oh, wow. Oh, whoa, man, yeah. That's a heavy duty concept. I mean, we hear about life reviews. Well, I have a group show that I do with a couple other guys. It's like a roundtable discussion. We do it twice a month. It's called The Union of the Unwanted. We did an episode several months ago. I'll send you the link to it. And it was all on near-death experiences. And we had scientists and doctors, and we had experiencers and people that were brought in, and they told, man, this one guy told a story of how he froze to death doing an ice climb with his buddy. And he went into such detail. Like we were all, there was like 20 people on this call, and like people were like in tears. I mean, it was like really emotional and crazy stuff. And I think that gets discounted as like woo woo and oh, you guys and everything. But look, I mean, I've done enough hallucinogen mushrooms and ayahuasca and DMT and peyote. And I've experienced that component of life or consciousness or however you want to describe that. There's, and of course there's always more to explore, but I've started that exploration, and I have discovered through my own experiences that stuff is, though it gets sort of kind of colored as being like, oh, you guys are all out there in the woods doing drugs or something, you know, it gets discounted and everything, but there's a huge amount of information out there and knowledge I guess more than anything, it just shifted my perspective a little bit in a way that maybe I had never, you know, you get into your conscious life and you're going to school and you're doing all the things and you're on this track and you get focused on it, which might be a good thing because you need to sort of concentrate and focus. But I got sidetracked. And so I would have from time to time these vacations, you know, these little trips that you'd go on for a couple hours, or it might be 12 hours if it's ayahuasca. And there was some very, very valuable and heavy duty information that was coming my way that I was unprepared for, trying to like drink out of a fire hose of information. And I promised myself that I would never discount that role, though I can't access it. I can't get to it every day in every moment, you know, in my waking, I kind of need help to get there. I promised I would never be dismissive of that stuff. So when you're talking about consciousness and you're talking about the mind and you're talking about near-death experiences, all that stuff, it's very easy for people that have no experience with it to just go, that's airy-fairy stuff. You guys are just talking about nonsense. But it might be the most important component of our whole, it might be the whole point of us being here is to get in touch with that. And yet this society that we have decided to live in that with governmental control has made the decision to keep us from that, right? Mm-hmm. Through laws and intentionally disconnecting us from that whole other component of us and putting us in cages if we get on the wrong side of their rules about exploring our consciousness. Graham Hancock had a quote talking, he says, I'll paraphrase it. It was something along the lines of, if we don't have the right to explore our own consciousness, then what is the point, you know?
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. An analogy that has helped me think about this consciousness question, and this is a lot of stuff in my first book and podcast series, is thinking of the brain rather than being the producer of consciousness, which is what I always thought it was, that a lot of there's chemical and electrical reactions in our brain and consciousness pops out of it as a result, right. Even though scientists will acknowledge it's called the hard problem of consciousness. Science Magazine has called it the number two question remaining in all of science. They don't know how that happens. So they acknowledge we don't know how it happens. What I argue
that's
is
a start. That's a good thing, because normally they're trying to tell us they have it all figured out. So at least I that's refreshing to know that they're admitting that they don't know it all.
Yes, so. It is. Although they would say to us, we don't know how it works yet, but we're going to figure it out just because we haven't gotten there yet. We know the brain does it, right? Gotcha. And what I've been arguing is it's the reverse, that the brain is more like either an antenna or a filtering mechanism. And this gets to your point about psychedelics, that the brain actually restricts and limits our perception of consciousness into what we perceive in this world. And there's a lot beyond that. So when you get the brain out of the way, whether it's a near-death experience or a psychedelic experience where there are certain reductions in brain functioning, there are a bunch of other cases like in savant syndrome, you know, people that have incredible mathematical abilities, they have impairments in their brain. So there's this pattern that you see, less brain, more consciousness. The analogy that Dr. Bernardo Castro, a philosopher, uses, which again is going to help with just thinking about this, for me it has, is that it's like there's an infinite stream of water, where water represents consciousness, and each of us is like a whirlpool within that stream. So we have the sense of being an individual, but we're interconnected. And when certain things happen, you get a perception of the broader stream of consciousness. So if you think about the life review from, if we, you know, adopt this analogy, it's something like the consciousness that we're a part of has an ability to view things through multiple whirlpools when the brain gets out of the way. And this, you know, these life review people, they can experience things through the eyes of the people that they impacted. So that's just my general framework for how I think about it.
Yeah. Well, whenever I hear life review, my mind immediately goes to one of the greatest movies ever made in the early 90s, Defending Your Life, with Albert Brooks and Meryl Streep. And they die on Earth and they have to go to this place that's like purgatory, right? It's like the waiting room, and they have a life review, and it's like a courtroom where they have a prosecutor and a defense attorney, and they have to go look through. They're sitting in they're sitting in this movie theater type thing with three judge panel, and they're watching on the screen parts of their life, like they're there, like they're 8 years old getting picked on in the playground, and he doesn't stand up for himself. And the whole point of the movie was that the prosecutor is saying, you know, you showed fear during your life. And if you showed fear, you can't advance. You've got to go back to Earth. You've got to go live. You got to go work this thing out. If you don't, if the only way you progress is to have this fearless thing. Now, what was interesting for me, I always thought the movie was hysterical because it's just the way they wrote it. It's just Albert Brooks is funny. It's a comedy, but there's a deeper meaning to it. And what's funny about it was that one of the times I went to an Acapulco, they have these like a la carte add-on experiences that you can purchase for your, you know, you watch the conferences all day and you hear all the speakers and everything. But then at night you can go do the ayahuasca adventure with all these shaman or whatever. And one of the times I did the DMT session with the shaman, and the experience, the first time I did it, the experience that I had with them was just like Defending Your Life. Like I was watching scenes from my well, one was a like a childhood, and two other scenes were like when I was much older. But I was watching the movie of my life, not from my own eyes, but it was like they'd set up a camera off to the side so that I could see me and the other people in it. It was a weird perspective. It was not my perspective. It was like I was having someone else's perspective. So I, you know, you come out of that session, I was just in tears, you know, like, oh my God, it was so heavy duty. But these experiences, you're talking about the guys you interview about near death experiences. Again, easy to discount that as like, you know, if someone's out there just making this stuff up. But with your podcast and when you talk to all these people, there's clearly something there. That's undeniable. But I wondered, was there a reason why some of these people, I mean, I don't expect them to really have the answer to this, but did you ever get a sense that of why some people got a life review and other people didn't?
Yeah, that's a great question. Something I've looked into. It's not clear whether it's something that everyone has. That's one theory, is that maybe it just happens to certain people. And also, it's really a question of memory. So Dr. Pim Van Lommel, a famous near-death experience researcher, published a paper in the Lancet Medical Journal. So this is, you know, high-end stuff, looking at people who had cardiac arrest and whether they came back having the features of a near-death experience. And it was something like 18% of them did. So people would ask a similar question. Well, Mark, what about those other 82%? That's just 18%. We don't know why. And maybe part of it is memory. They could have had the experience, but for whatever reason, when they're resuscitated, they don't remember it. But the fact that it does happen at all, to me, is what's significant. And also, this has probably been the strongest piece of evidence that I've found for near-death experiences being real, at least sometimes, rather than hallucinations, is that some of the reported memories upon being resuscitated are validated as accurate. So let's say the person has an out-of-body experience, so they claim they're hovering over their body. Sometimes they're hovering outside the room, and they come back and they're resuscitated and they tell this doctor what happened. And they say, oh, like there's one example in my podcast, this is in episode 5, of a person who saw a leg being amputated in the room next door, and they were putting it into this yellow bag. And the doctor in her room, when she was resuscitated, didn't know about that until he checked the medical records, and it was correct in some of the things she described. So there's a book called The Self Does Not Die, which documents over 100 of these cases, which are very difficult to document because you need a lot of things happening at once where you can validate it. There should be zero cases of a validated memory at the time when the brain should not be capable of producing anything, let alone a complex memory from outside the body. And so for me, that is not it's not hallucinatory. It's a verified memory. So right. If that's true, that it's not a hallucination, it lends credence to the idea that some of these other experiences are true, which tells us maybe there's something going on in the nature of reality that's built into it.
I remember hearing the story of Nikki Sixx from Motley Crue talking about how he saw himself dead on this gurney getting wheeled into an ambulance, and he saw the guy plunge the thing down, and then he came flying back into his body and was like, you know, like away, because he had OD'd on heroin. And he said, I could see the whole scene. I could see me getting wheeled into the ambulance and all that stuff. So I think there's something to this. And you know, David Icke talks about, you know, he's talks about like, you know, he's like, you know, you've got a computer and then you've got Wi-Fi. Where's the Wi-Fi? You know, it works, right? So he's trying to make the comparison between the way Wi-Fi is sort of this invisible wave, you know, these invisible waves out there, and your brain is like the computer or maybe the router that needs, you got to have that in order to pull the Wi-Fi. And people say, well, where's the signal coming from? Well, the signal is kind of everywhere. And what, where's consciousness coming from? Well, consciousness is kind of everywhere, right? But you have to have the right hardware. Like maybe your brain has to be the computer that taps into that, that connects it. Is that a fair assessment of something like that?
Yeah, that's the way I think about it. And that explains why if you have a person who, let's say, gets in a car accident, damages the brain, and then has memory loss, we might be able to point to the part of the brain that was damaged and say, look, there's this correlation between what happened to your brain and the type of conscious experience you have. It's like the antenna is altered. And where I think there's a lot of confusion is people will say, well, look, Mark, no, it's the other way around. The reason that there's this correlation is because the brain's creating consciousness. And that explains why if you damage this part of the brain, you don't have memory loss. But it could be the reverse. which is that, no, the brain is tapping into something. And just like an antenna, if you're watching your TV and you take a hammer to your antenna and then your TV screen's fuzzy, you can't watch the show. Right. It's not because the signal has been damaged. It's because the apparatus for processing the signal has been damaged. And that's how I think about it.
Yeah. And well, we've got stories of plants communicating with each other. They don't have brains, right? They're talking to each other in the forest and things like that. Spores and mushrooms and all these things. There's lots of studies talking about how these things communicate with other things around them. So this has got to be part of a much bigger invisible field, right? I don't know, whatever you want to call it, energy, consciousness, a combination of all of that. It can't just be brain related, right? There's got to be, because some things out there don't have brains and they're functioning in this conscious soup of whatever it is out there, right? I mean, is that reasonable?
Yeah, that's how I think about it generally. And there's also this other area of like psychic phenomena,
yeah,
which is supported by this idea of an interconnected field. It's almost like the water from one whirlpool getting into another person's whirlpool.
Right.
You know, that there's something it's known as non-local consciousness. And to give you an example, I mean, the US government had a program on remote viewing, which is the ability to perceive things from far away using your mind. And I'll give an example. Dr. Jessica Utz, who is a statistician, in 2016, she was the president of the American Statistical Association. She was asked to review the data for this remote viewing, the psychic phenomenon, in addition to other psychic phenomena. This was back in 1995. She said, using the standards applied to any other area of science, it is concluded that psychic functioning has been well established. Looking at the statistics, so sometimes it's a very subtle effect. And I'll give you a quick example, because this stuff kind of blew me away, because if I buy into statistics and I like my old self didn't want to accept this, but I've gotten closer to it. Now I have the classic study on telepathy. Okay. You have one person, we'll call him Bob, who's in one room. Jane is in another room and she's put into a really relaxed state, just kind of hanging out. Bob is shown a movie or some image. He's looking at it and he's told by the researchers to try to mentally send it to the other person. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then the other person comes out of the relaxed state and is shown four images and they say, which one was he sending to you? Okay. And you pick one. Over time, you would expect that person to guess correctly one out of four times, because there should be no information transferred. If they're not speaking, there should be no mental transfer. But what the researchers find is that it's closer to 32%, which statistically speaking is very significant. And it falls into a category that Dr. Dean Radin, who's the chief scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, it's one of the Six Sigma categories, meaning statistically speaking, the odds against chance are more than 1 billion to 1, meaning in other areas of science, when you see that kind of effect, you accept it as real. Even if it's small, it's beyond what chance would predict, which makes sense, actually, because if we were all 100% telepathic or psychic or could do remote viewing all the time, then we would know everything about each other. But we don't. Sometimes maybe we have an event that's like, oh, I thought of that person. They called. The idea is that it's subtle and it's like some of the water is getting from one whirlpool to another. And this gets back to our political discussion. If consciousness is non-local, then maybe these near-death experiences and other spiritually transformative experiences, people call them, are not hallucinations. And therefore, maybe the golden rule is not just a common sense thing, but it's a natural law. And that's the term Dr. Grayson from UVA says. He talks to these various people who've come back and it's beyond morality. That's what he said. It's natural law.
Whoa, that's a really fascinating component of this. I thought, you know, you were in the Bay Area for a long time. I've probably heard of Stanford Research Institute, yeah, and the work that they did, Pat Price, Ingo Swann, all these guys talking about remote viewing. And there was a story of Ingo Swann back in the mid-70s when the Voyager probes were getting ready to go to Jupiter, and they asked him to remote view Jupiter in advance of the probes, and he said, there's a ring around it. And they said, no, you're picking up Saturn. He said, no, I know what Saturn looks like. It's not Saturn, it's Jupiter. And I'm telling you right now, there's a ring around it. They said, well, our telescopes don't show that. It's not there. We'll see. Probe gets to Jupiter. Sure enough, there's a ring around it. They said, how did you know that? He said, I could see it. And they're like, how can you see it? It's like, why did you hire me? I can see things that you guys can't see. To be to be dismissive of remote viewing is to do so at your own detriment. There are lots of studies that these guys know, you know, I mean, and obviously there's a set out there that may be grifters. There's always the,
yeah, sure,
to be fair. But I think that the concept of remote viewing, though definitely difficult for a certain, you know, segment of society to come to terms with, because it just seems like fantastical, right? Like an impossibility. We have seen study after study showing that is a real phenomenon. What did you find out from the remote viewing people that you talked to? Like, were there limits to it? Because from what I've seen, it seemed like they were unlimited in their reach.
I think, to me, psychic abilities are sort of like maybe abilities in anything else, like sports, for example. Mm-hmm. You have someone who can dribble a basketball, and then you have LeBron James or Michael Jordan. There's a spectrum of abilities, and some people are just naturally better than others. Right. And the government apparently was able to get some of those superstar people that have a natural ability, even though we all might have that ability. Right. And when I interviewed Russell Targ, who was one of the people that ran the program for remote viewing, he used to teach people. I think he still might do it. Teach people how to calm their mind and essentially access anything. Now, the question is, are there things that are blocked? Like, I don't know how it fully works, but the research over and over shows, and this was also done at Princeton. There was a lab run by the former dean of engineering for almost 30 years, looking at remote viewing and also psychokinesis, which is mind impacting matter without a physical contact. So they were running this stuff. I was at Princeton, didn't know about it. It was super controversial. But this idea is that consciousness is beyond space and time. And you just have to be able to tap into that. And so governments are wanting to use this sort of thing. And my podcast series, episode 4, has my interview with Russell Targ. But there's a declassified CIA document, which is great for me as a researcher. It's in chapter 4 of my book, of my first book, and End Upside Down Thinking. Remote viewing is a real phenomenon. Implications are revolutionary. And they show the scientists that looked at it. In addition to lots of other documents, but that's
right,
pretty significant.
Yeah, when they have to admit that it's a real thing, then hey, listen. I mean, look, it's real. Russell Targ has done outstanding work. Yeah, he's an interesting guy. But it's so funny because the two things like don't go together in my mind. Government and consciousness, like the most unconscious sort of thing is the government. You know, it's just sort of like I always sort of describe, like, the American government is like that big drunk football player in the bar that's just going over and sticking their fingers in everybody's faces and yelling at them, you know, causing problems, and it's just, it's not operating at this high level. It's real, you know, brute force and aggression and stupidity and anger and in all of this. And then consciousness is the opposite, right? It's just this elevated state, or it could be an elevated state and everything. How do we get these two things to work together? Because if we could get that, if we could have a government that was run basically with the intention of having a focus on the conscious component, it seems like that could be a utopian type society. But is it that human nature gets in the way of this, or where is the disconnect? Why can't we put these two things together in a way that makes sense?
Yeah, great question. So I had to think about this a lot in writing the book. It starts for me with, why does life matter? Why are we here? If society becomes enslaved, does it matter? Because if we're just going to die and that's it, the end of our consciousness, then actually maybe it doesn't even matter in the end. Or maybe there is some deeper meaning and our consciousness continues, in which case we have to think about organizing society because there's a moral imperative. There's a reason that we're here. So to answer your question, I want to connect another piece of evidence that I talk about mostly in my first book and my podcast series of children who have past life memories. Another thing I never would have considered as possibly being real.
Yeah.
But there's over 2,500 cases studied at the University of Virginia for decades, where in some cases, this child who's between the ages of 2 and 5 years old describes some past life, not necessarily a famous person, usually just some obscure thing like a fighter pilot in World War II or a Hollywood extra. And the researchers are able to find historical evidence that aligns with what the child is saying in ways that they can't explain through any other means other than this consciousness used to be in that body somehow. And in some cases, the children have physical birthmarks or defects that align with how the person died in the previous life. So crazy stuff. But if you accept that for a second and like suspend disbelief, it suggests that reincarnation could explain this phenomenon. If you combine the possibility of reincarnation with the life review, the idea of evolution at the level of our consciousness becomes a possibility as the meaning of life or one of the primary aspects of life. We're here to embody principles of treating others well because we're interconnected somehow. And we do have a life review, or maybe some of us do, and we get to see how we treated other people. And what people say in the life review is that there wasn't a third party judging them, like religion say, it's themselves. They're judging themselves harshly.
Ooh.
Like, I should have known better, or wow, I'm really happy I did that. So, okay, let's say we are here to evolve at some level, and we're here to try to treat other people well because we're part of this interconnected thing. We're actually one, not separate, even though we appear separate. Then society should be structured in a way that values those ideas of treating other people well, which to me, voluntarism is the epitome of that, which is not initiating aggression against people or their private property, mm-hmm. and also enabling evolution, giving people the freedom to evolve, which means that people have to be allowed to make mistakes and to thrive on their own terms. Whereas government comes in, like we're seeing right now, and they say, we're going to tell you what risks you're going to take with regard to this illness. Forget about every other illness that causes much more death and destruction that's out there. We're not going to tell you what to do, but for this one, we're going to control all of your risk. Whereas in a freer society, you determine your own risk. And if you make mistakes, it's part of your evolutionary process. And to me, voluntarism allows this much better than our current system.
Yeah. And if you operate from a place of knowing that you will be sort of having to have a life review, or at least, I don't know if judged is the right word, but you're going to have to talk about what you've done in the end. And you have the understanding that, there's the reincarnation component to this. You might come back here again. That just in and of itself could create the internal mechanisms in a person that would prevent them from ever wanting to live in a society that has psychotic governments ruling over them. It would just be inconsistent or incongruent with their belief system. And I can't sign up for the U.S. military. Are you crazy? I can't do that. I can't go shoot somebody if I know that I have to have a life review and go through what that Vietnam vet went through. He's like, it was bad. So even just an understanding of that kind of makes part of the framework of government just untenable, right? I mean, you just couldn't, who would sign up to go be a soldier if you know that you're going to have to answer for what you've done in that war right now? I mean, it's the fraud of government is that as long as you're wearing a costume when you kill somebody, you're fine.
Yeah, right. You know? The term that Larkin Rose, the philosopher in this area, he calls it an exemption from morality. The government can do things that no normal citizen can do, and it's fine and perfectly legal, and it's actually justified as righteous. So where you're headed is exactly how I'm thinking about it, Charlie, is that it's a two-pronged, I call it a metaphysical political philosophy. Mm-hmm. And I draw out this 2x2 matrix. So imagine the horizontal axis. On one end is your highly, we'll call it spiritual. The term that people often use is non-dual, meaning there's only one consciousness, and that's our fundamental reality. So you have non-dual on one side, and you have what some would call physicalist, that everything is just physical. When you die, that's it. There's no meaning built into reality. You can make meaning, but you're just rationalizing. It doesn't actually exist fundamentally. Okay, so you're on one end of the spectrum. And I'm saying there's a lot of scientific evidence which pushes us toward the non-dual, quote-unquote, spiritual. But then there's also the political aspect of statism on one side and voluntarism on the, this is the vertical axis. So statism, voluntarism, you could make either axis. The point is that you end up in a quadrant of being non-dual and involuntarism,
right?
Because you could have four different things, whether you're highly spiritual, non-spiritual, statism, voluntarism. And to me, you need to have both. So what I'm envisioning is not something that's going to happen tomorrow, most likely, but right. It's sort of like, how are you most aligned with reality and where can we move, given that our structures are falling apart and people are starting to realize, I hope, that this is not tenable. So that's one point I want to make. The other one is more subtle, but I think it's super important. People could say, well, okay, Mark and Charlie, let's say we're going to suspend disbelief and believe that we're part of one consciousness. Mm-hmm. Then we could do statism because people are going to, they're not going to want to harm others. And we don't need to have a contractual relationship and government can still be there. The problem is, and this is more my second book and End Upside Down Living. When you look at people that get towards aligning themselves with this unified field, some would call it the state of enlightenment, where they're like literally living in a bliss state where they're having little experiences of it, not always doing psychedelics or near-death experience. It's their day-to-day. Mm-hmm. And there's a great podcast called Buddha at the Gas Pump, where Rick Archer, the host, has interviewed over 500 people that have had these experiences. And many of them are normal people that right. have these awakenings. The problem is that even when you get to a super high level of awakening, people can be corrupted. And it's known as the fallen guru syndrome, effectively, where you have a spiritual teacher who's super enlightened, and maybe they are, but something gets them, and it's usually money, sex, or power. So there's, it's like we have this duality of light, dark, good, evil, and anyone's susceptible. And this is the subtle point I want to make, is that statism is going to make the temptation still exist for even someone super enlightened, whereas voluntarism is going to make it more difficult for a corrupted person to do damage.
Yeah. Oh my God. I just remember hearing about this a couple, it must have been a couple of weeks ago. They're talking about like Wim Hof and all these guys. They're like, oh, it was like all the like kind of running cults or anything. Like, oh, yeah. That guy got busted. He's got like four wives and he's got all the, you know, it's like all these people that you were like, oh, he's this great guru. And you're just like, no, it turns out he's a real scumbag. And you're like, oh man, like all these people, I was kind of holding out hope that, that these people would be the good guys. And it turns out they're not yet. Well, look, it's tough living in this world, right? We get conflicting statements. We're told one thing, reality shows us something different. We're told this side is off limits. Don't talk about that. Don't look into that. And meanwhile, you're only allowed to believe this acceptable version of reality. The state itself needs to limit your perception in order to keep control of you. So by default, they are corrupt in that they won't allow us to be who we should be. And so the state needs to go away. Your book, An End to Upside Down Liberty, I think is a good way for people to maybe take a look at their relationship between the state and their state of mind. Right.
Yes.
So where can people get it? Tell us where the best place to find your work, your podcast, and all that stuff.
Sure. My website is my name, markgober.com. So MARKGOBER. And that has info on my books and my podcast. All three of my books are available in hard copy, Kindle, and Audible, and you can find them on Amazon.
That's Mark Gober, everybody. Check out his book, support his work, listen to his podcast, man. I'm going to check it out. I definitely want to hear the one with Russell Targ. If you've liked this episode, take the additional step of sharing it with your friends and family. You can connect with me through the website, The Octopus of Global Control. Thanks, Mark. You're the best. We appreciate it. And we will talk to everybody soon.
Yeah. Thank you, Charlie.